Chapter 9. A week of buffeting a tempestuous and relentless sea, a week of seasickness and deserted cabins, of lonely quarterdecks drenched with spray, so ambitious that it even coated the smokestacks thick with a white crust of salt to their very tops. A week of shivering in the shelter of the lifeboats, and deckhouses by day and blowing suffocating clouds and boisterously performing at dominoes, in the smoking room at night. And the last night of the seven, was the stormiest of all. There was no thunder, no noise but the pounding bows of the ship, the keen whistling of the gale through the cordage, and the rush of the seething waters. But the vessel climbed aloft, as if she would climb to heaven, then paused an instant, that seemed a century, and plunged headlong down again, as from a precipice. The sheeted sprays drenched the decks like rain. The blackness of darkness was everywhere. At long intervals a flash of lightning clove it with a quivering line of fire, that revealed a heaving world of water where was nothing before, kindled the dusky cordage to glittering silver, and lit up the faces of the men with a ghastly luster. Fear drove many on deck, that were used to avoiding the night winds and the spray. Some thought the vessel could not live through the night, and it seemed less dreadful to stand out in the midst of the wild tempest, and see the peril that threatened than to be shut up in the sepulchral cabins, under the dim lamps, and imagine the horrors that were abroad on the ocean. And once out, where they could see the ship struggling in the strong grasp of the storm once, where they could hear the shriek of the winds, and face the driving spray and look out upon the majestic picture the lightnings disclosed, they were prisoners to a fierce fascination they could not resist, and so remained. It was a wild night and a very, very long one. Everybody was sent scampering to the deck at 7 o'clock this lovely morning of the 30th of June with the glad news that a land was in sight. It was a rare thing and a joyful to see all the ship's family abroad once more, albeit the happiness that sat upon every countenance could only partly conceal the ravages which that long siege of storms had wrought there. But dull eyes soon sparkled with pleasure. Pallid cheeks flushed again, and frames weakened by sickness gathered new life from the quickening influences of the bright fresh morning. Yea, and from a still more potent influence. The worn castaways were to see the blessed land again. And to see it was to bring back that motherland that was in all their thoughts. Within the hour we were fairly within the Straits of Gibraltar, the tall yellow splotched hills of Africa on our right, with their bases veiled in a blue haze, and their summits swathed in clouds, the same being according to Scripture, which says that clouds and darkness are over the land. The words were spoken of this particular portion of Africa, I believe. On our left were the granite-ribbed domes of Old Spain. The strait is only 13 miles wide in its narrowest part. At short intervals along the Spanish shore were quaint-looking old stone towers, Moorish, we thought, but learned better afterwards. In former times the Morocco rascals used to coast along the Spanish main in their boats till a safe opportunity seemed to present itself, and then dart in and capture a Spanish village, and carry off all the pretty women they could find. It was a pleasant business, and was very popular. The Spaniards built these watchtowers on the hills, to enable them to keep a sharper lookout on the Moroccan speculators. The picture on the other edge, and was very beautiful to eyes weary of the changeless sea, and by the ship's company grew wonderfully cheerful. But while we stood admiring the cloud-capped peaks, and the lowlands robed in misty gloom, a finer picture burst upon us, and chained every eye like a magnet. A stately ship, with canvas piled on canvas till she was one towering mass of bellying sail. She came speeding over the sea like a great bird. Africa and Spain were forgotten. All homage was for the beautiful stranger. While everybody gazed, she swept superbly by, and flung the stars and stripes to the breeze. Quicker than thought, hats and handkerchiefs flashed in the air, and a cheer went up. She was beautiful, before she was radiant now. Many a one on our decks knew then for the first time how tame a sight his country's flag is at home compared to what it is in a foreign land. To see it is to see a vision of home itself and all its idols, and feel a thrill that would stir a very river of sluggish blood. We were approaching the famed Pillars of Hercules, and already the African one, Apes Hill, a grand old mountain with summits streaked with granite ledges, was in sight. The other, the great rock of Gibraltar, was yet to come. The ancients considered the Pillars of Hercules the head of navigation, and the end of the world. The information the ancients didn't have was very voluminous. Even the prophets wrote book after book and epistle after epistle, yet never once hinted at the existence of a great continent on our side of the water, yet they must have known it was there, I should think. In a few moments a lonely and enormous mass of rock, standing seemingly in the center of the wide strait, and apparently washed on all sides by the sea, swung magnificently into view, and we needed no tedious traveled parrot to tell us it was Gibraltar. There could not be two rocks like that in one kingdom. The rock of Gibraltar is about a mile and a half long, I should say, by 1,400 to 1,500 feet high, and a quarter of a mile wide at its base. One side and one end of it come about as straight up out of the sea as the side of a house, the other end is irregular, and the other side is a steep slant which an army would find very difficult to climb. At the foot of this slant is the walled town of Gibraltar, or rather the town occupies part of the slant. Everywhere on hillside, in the precipice, by the sea, on the heights, everywhere you choose to look, Gibraltar is clad with masonry and bristling with guns. It makes a striking and lively picture from whatsoever point you contemplate it. It is pushed out into the sea on the end of a flat, narrow strip of land, and is suggestive of a ob of mud on the end of a shingle. A few hundred yards of this flat ground at its base belongs to the English, and then, extending across the strip from the Atlantic to the Mediterranean, a distance of a quarter of a mile, comes the neutral ground, a space 200 or 300 yards wide, which is free to both parties. Are you going through Spain to Paris? That question was bandied about the ship day and night from Fayal to Gibraltar, and I thought I never could get so tired of hearing any one combination of words again, or more tired of answering, I don't know. At the last moment, 6 or 7 had sufficient decision of character to make up their minds to go, and did go, and I felt a sense of relief at once. It was forever too late now, and I could make up my mind at my leisure not to go. I must have a prodigious quantity of mind. It takes me as much as a week sometimes to make it up. But behold how annoyances repeat themselves. We had no sooner gotten rid of the Spain distress than the Gibraltar guide started another a tiresome repetition of a legend that had nothing very astonishing about it, even in the first place: colon that high hill yonder is called the Queen's Chair. It is because one of the queens of Spain placed her chair there when the French and Spanish troops were besieging Gibraltar, and said she would never move from the spot till the English flag was lowered from the fortresses. If the English hadn't been gallant enough to lower the flag for a few hours one day, she'd have had to break her oath or die up there. We rode on asses and mules up the steep, narrow streets and entered the subterranean galleries the English have blasted out in the rock. These galleries are like spacious railway tunnels, and at short intervals in them great guns frown out upon sea and town through portholes 500 or 600 feet above the ocean. There is a mile or so of this subterranean work, and it must have cost a vast deal of money and labor. The gallery guns command the peninsula and the harbors of both oceans, but they might as well not be there, I should think, for an army could hardly climb the perpendicular wall of the rock anyhow. Those lofty portholes afford superb views of the sea, though. At one place, where a jutting crag was hollowed out into a great chamber whose furniture was huge cannon, and whose windows were portholes, a glimpse was caught of a hill not far away, and a soldier said, "That high hill yonder is called the Queen's Chair. It is because a queen of Spain placed her chair there once, when the French and Spanish troops were besieging Gibraltar, and said she would never move from the spot till the English flag was lowered from the fortresses. If the English hadn't been gallant enough to lower the flag for a few hours one day, she'd have had to break her oath, or die up there. On the topmost pinnacle of Gibraltar we halted a good while, and no doubt the mules were tired. They had a right to be. The military road was good, but rather steep, and there was a good deal of it. The view from the narrow ledge was magnificent. From it vessels seeming like the tiniest little toy boats were turned into noble ships by the telescopes, and other vessels, that were 50 miles away and even 60, they said, and invisible to the naked eye, could be clearly distinguished through those same telescopes. Below, on one side, we looked down upon an endless mass of batteries, and on the other straight down to the sea. While I was resting ever so comfortably on a rampart, and cooling my baking head in the delicious breeze, an officious guide belonging to another party came up and said, "Senor, that high hill yonder is called the Queen's Chair. Sir, I am a helpless orphan in a foreign land. Have pity on me. Don't inflict that most infernal old legend on me anymore today." There I had used strong language, after promising I would never do so again, but the provocation was more than human nature could bear. If you had been bored so, when you had the noble panorama of Spain and Africa, and the blue Mediterranean spread abroad at your feet, and wanted to gaze and enjoy and surfeit yourself in its beauty in silence, you might have even burst into stronger language than I did. Gibraltar has stood several protracted sieges, one of them of nearly 4 years' duration. It failed, and the English only captured it by stratagem. The wonder is that anybody should ever dream of trying so impossible a project as the taking it by assault, and yet it has been tried more than once. The Moors held the place 1,200 years ago, and a staunch old castle of theirs of that date still frowns from the middle of the town, with moss-grown battlements and sites well scarred by shots fired in battles and sieges that are forgotten now. A secret chamber in the rock behind it was discovered some time ago, which contained a sword of exquisite workmanship, and some quaint old armor of a fashion that antiquaries are not acquainted with, though it is supposed to be Roman. Roman armor and Roman relics of various kinds have been found in a cave in the sea extremity of Gibraltar. History says Rome held this part of the country about the Christian era, and these things seem to confirm the statement. In that cave also are found human bones, crusted with a very thick stony coating, and wise men have ventured to say that those men not only lived before the flood, but as much as 10,000 years before it. It may be true, it looks reasonable enough, but, as long as those parties can't vote anymore, the matter can be of no great public interest. In this cave likewise are found skeletons and fossils of animals that exist in every part of Africa, yet within memory and tradition have never existed in any portion of Spain save this lone peak of Gibraltar. So the theory is that the channel between Gibraltar and Africa was once dry land, and that the low, neutral neck between Gibraltar and the Spanish hills behind it was once ocean, and of course, that these African animals, being over at Gibraltar after rock, perhaps there is plenty there, got closed out when the great change occurred. The hills in Africa, across the channel, are full of apes, and there are now and always have been apes on the rock of Gibraltar but not elsewhere in Spain. The subject is an interesting one. There is an English garrison at Gibraltar of 6,000 or 7,000 men, and so uniforms of flaming red are plenty, and red and blue, and undress costumes of snowy white, and also the queer uniform of the bare-kneed Highlander. And one sees soft-eyed Spanish girls from San Roque, and veiled Moorish beauties, I suppose they are beauties, from Tarifa, and turbaned, sashed, and trousered Moorish merchants from Fez, and long-robed, bare-legged, ragged Muhammadan vagabonds from Tetuan and Tangier, some brown, some yellow and some as black as virgin ink, and Jews from all around, in gabardine, skullcap, and slippers, just as they are in pictures and theaters, and just as they were 3,000 years ago, no doubt. You can easily understand that a tribe, somehow our pilgrims suggest that expression, because they march in a straggling procession through these foreign places with such an Indian-like air of complacency and independence about them, like ours, made up from 15 or 16 states of the Union, found enough to stare at in this shifting panorama of fashion today. Speaking of our pilgrims, reminds me that we have one or two people among us who are sometimes an annoyance. However, I do not count the Oracle in that list. I will explain that the Oracle is an innocent old ass who eats 4-4, and looks wiser than the whole Academy of France would have any right to look, and never uses a one-syllable word when he can think of a longer one, and never by any possible chance knows the meaning of any long word he uses, or ever gets it in the right place. Yet he will serenely venture an opinion on the most abstruse subject, and back it up complacently with quotations from authors who never existed, and finally when cornered will slide to the other side of the question, say he has been there all the time, and come back at you with your own spoken arguments, only with the big words all tangled, and play them in your very teeth as original with himself. He reads a chapter in the guidebooks, mixes the facts all up with his bad memory, and then goes off to inflict the whole mess on somebody as wisdom which has been festering in his brain for years, and which he gathered in college from erudite authors who are dead now, and out of print. This morning at breakfast he pointed out of the window and said, "Do you see that there hill out there on that African coast? It's one of them pillows of Hercules, I should say, and there's the ultimate one alongside of it. The ultimate one, that is a good word, but the pillars are not both on the same side of the strait." I saw he had been deceived by a carelessly written sentence in the guidebook. Well, it ain't for you to say, nor for me. Some authors states it that way, and some states it different. Old Gibbons don't say nothing about it, just shirks it complete. Gibbons always done that when he got stuck, but there is Rollampton. What does he say? Why, he says that they was both on the same side, and Trinculian, and Sobister, and Syracuse, and Langemargand. Oh, that will do, that's enough. If you have got your hand in for inventing authors and testimony, I have nothing more to say, let them be on the same side. We don't mind the Oracle. We rather like him. We can tolerate the Oracle very easily, but we have a poet and a good-natured enterprising idiot on board, and they do distress the company. The one gives copies of his verses to consuls, commanders, hotel keepers, Arabs, Dutch, to anybody, in fact, who will submit to a grievous infliction most kindly meant. His poetry is all very well on shipboard, notwithstanding when he wrote Anda to the ocean in a storm in 1/2 hour, and an apostrophe to the rooster in the waist of the ship in the next, the transition was considered to be rather abrupt. But when he sends an invoice of rhymes to the governor of Fayal, and another to the commander-in-chief, and other dignitaries in Gibraltar with the compliments of the laureate of the ship, it is not popular with the passengers. The other personage I have mentioned is young and green, and not bright, not learned, and not wise. He will be, though, someday if he recollects the answers to all his questions. He is known about the ship as the interrogation point, and this by constant use has become shortened to interrogation. He has distinguished himself twice already. In Fayal they pointed out a hill, and told him it was 800 feet high and 100 feet long. And they told him there was a tunnel 2,000 feet long and 1,000 feet high running through the hill, from end to end. He believed it. He repeated it to everybody, discussed it, and read it from his notes. Finally, he took a useful hint from this remark, which a thoughtful old pilgrim made. Well, yes, it is a little remarkable singular tunnel altogether, stands up out of the top of the hill about 200 feet, and one end of it sticks out of the hill about 900. Here in Gibraltar he corners these educated British officers, and badgers them with braggadocio about America, and the wonders she can perform. He told one of them a couple of our gunboats could come here and knock Gibraltar into the Mediterranean Sea. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.